Let's pick up where we finished last time. Remember, the free Klein-Gordon quantum field in a generic curved space-time has to obey the hermeticity conditions, in particular the equations of motion, which can be generated by the Hamiltonian, which is a self-adjoint operator, and therefore generates unitary time evolution, even on curved space-time. And we saw that these equations of motion can be put into the form of the Klein-Gordon equation and the relationship between the canonically conjugate field and the space and time derivatives of the field. Further, in addition to the hermeticity conditions and the equations of motion, our quantum field also has to obey the canonical commutation relations on all space-like hypersurfaces, sigma. So we should be able to choose any coordinate system we want, and therefore any slicing of space-time into equal time hypersurfaces. And we should find that whatever slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces we choose, we have the canonical commutation relations at equal time. We pursued a particular ansatz to solve the problem, of having these three conditions, hermeticity, equation of motion, and canonical commutation relations solved. And the ansatz is this one. I should say that it is succeeding for free theories, but it would not succeed for interacting theories. It would not succeed for self-interacting theories, such as the phi to the 4 theory, for example. It wouldn't give us a complete solution. At best, we can use it as a starting point for perturbation theory. But on a curved space-time, being able to solve the free Klein-Gordon equation is already highly non-trivial. So we pursue that anyway. So the ansatz that we use is that the field is a linear combination of A and A dagger operators that are chosen to be frozen in time, just fixed constant operators that obey these commutation relations, multiplied with so-called mode functions, which are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, number-valued, complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and we sum over many of them. So we have three ingredients here, these operators, these time-dependent functions, and we have an infinite sum of them. And the purpose of that is that having these operators will ensure the canonical commutation relations. Together with the sum, we notice that we have to sum, we can't just use one solution here. And the fact that these are constant, but those obey the Klein-Gordon equation will ensure that all of this also obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. And then the way that this is the Hermitian conjugate to that ensures that the hermeticity condition is also true. So far, we've showed already that the hermeticity conditions and the equations of motion are obeyed at all time in this way. And we showed that if we choose a fixed coordinate system, then the canonical commutation relations are obeyed at all time if we choose for these mode functions a bunch of solutions which obey this so-called Wronskian condition. So remember, we are dealing here with the function space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. You can also view this as this function space defined as the kernel of the Klein-Gordon operator. The Klein-Gordon operator is Dannenberg'schen plus m squared. So it's the set of eigenvectors of that operator to eigenvalue 0. Now that looks like a difficult to fulfill condition, but we showed using Darboux's theorem that there always exists a set of solutions, UK, complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation such that this equation holds true at some once we've chosen some fixed coordinate system, once we've chosen a foliation of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. How can we see that the canonical commutation relations are conserved in time? Well, it turns out that one way to see that, apart from the business of the differential equations that we did earlier, is that it is implied by the self-adjointness of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian that we obtained via the Legendre transform is still a self-adjoint operator. It is time-dependent if the space-time is time-dependent, but that doesn't change the fact that it is self-adjoint at every point in time. So in particular, we can exponentiate it to obtain a unitary operator in this way. Remember that there's a time-ordering operator in here, which makes this a non-trivial power series in which every term has to be ordered in such a way that the Hamiltonians, the powers of the Hamiltonian that arise there, are always ordered in time. But at the end of it, this is a unitary operator that obeys the time evolution equations. And whenever we have that a system is evolving unitarily, then whichever commutation relations hold at one point in time will hold at all times. And that's easy to see in this way. In the Heisenberg picture, we can write the field operators as a function of time as the field operators at the initial time t naught, and then time evolved using the time evolution operator. And similarly, we can work with the canonically conjugate momentum field. And then let's see, what is the commutator between the field and its canonically conjugate momentum at a later time? Well, we can just plug in these expressions that we have for the late fields and the canonically conjugate field, plug it in here, and then we get a u dagger phi, u inverse, u pi, u inverse. And if you write out what that is, you find that you get this multiplied with that, where the middle u and u inverse cancel each other out. And you get another term minus this times that. And again, you have in the middle a u and a u inverse that cancel another out. So overall, we obtain that this commutator is actually the commutator of just the phi and the pi at the initial time t naught, as they stand here, and the u and the u daggers can be pulled outside of the commutator. But that commutator here is a Dirac delta. And in particular, it's a Dirac delta multiplied with the identity operator. So we can pull this through that u, annihilates this u inverse. And so we find that the commutation relations are obeyed. But is this quantization, as we discussed earlier, is it coordinate system independent? So let's assume we solve the theory as we did in the previous lecture and as I just reviewed now. And now let's imagine we change the coordinate system and therefore the choices of what we call equal-time events. So if we change coordinate system, then fixing the time means that we fix a whole set of events that we say all have the same time. And such a space-like hypersurface depends on which coordinate system we choose. So let's say we change that. So visually, you can think of the space-like hypersurface as being, you can think of space-time as, let's say, having space directions in these directions. And then let's visualize the time direction as going upwards. And then one slicing of space-time would be like this. Another slicing of space-time might be like that. So we can deform our space-like hypersurfaces by having them grow bumps, for example. Then how do we know that if we quantize this other way, we would still get the same theory? How do we know that the canonical commutation relations keep holding up when deforming what we call space-like hypersurfaces of equal time? So to see that this is actually working, And if you think about it, it's a bit of a miracle that it does work, right? Because we work here with the Hamiltonian formalism. And in the action formalism with the Lagrangian, everything looks beautifully covariant. But in the Hamiltonian formalism, everything looks a little awkward. And that we can still get away with imposing canonical commutation relations and then they just evolve forward in a fully generally covariant way, that's quite non-trivial. But it's true. So let's prove this. For that purpose, let us write the symplectic form, the product that we defined between two solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, in this case, two real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. Remember, any solution is a simple linear combination of a real-valued solution plus I times another real-valued solution. So let us write the symplectic form more abstractly. We have defined the symplectic form, the product between two real-number valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation in this way. So here we have the derivatives of the solutions and then the metric and square root of the determinant and so on. Let us rewrite that using some differential geometry. Namely, let us rewrite the whole thing as a differential 3 form. It is a differential 3 form because if you remember, well, if you took my course last term, you remember. The technical details don't matter that much for what we do now. Of what we do now, it doesn't matter that much for what we do later. It's just the proof of an intermediate result. So it's a general result of differential geometry that if you want to do an integral over a p-dimensional manifold or submanifold, then what you can integrate is only a p form. So for example, if you want to do a four-dimensional integral, you need a 4 form. If you want to integrate a three-dimensional integral, namely over space for fixed time, then you need a 3 form. Okay, so this is a 3 form. Let's call it J tilde. And actually, this is the structure of it. So first of all, we take this thing here, this much, and that is a vector field, a contravariant vector field. Why? Well, because this is a scalar function, h is a scalar function, then this derivative of a scalar function is a covariant vector. So now we have covariant vector and scalar function. So the whole thing is a covariant vector, but then we contract it with a metric upstairs, and then we get a contravariant vector. Okay, so that is the contravariant vector, the J mu of x and t, or contravariant vector field. And how do we get a 3 form now? Well, there's a canonical way to get a 3 form, and that is this 3 form. And that is, you take that contravariant vector, now this one, take that contravariant vector, and you feed it to the volume form. If you remember, the volume form is a differential 4 form. It takes 4 vector fields as argument. And we feed it one vector field, namely this one. And then it still feeds on 3 vector fields. It is a 3 form now. So this is the inner derivation. I'm hoping that you're familiar with this, but it's not a disaster if you're not familiar with this. So what we have is that what we integrate over is a 3 form, and that 3 form is the inner derivation of the volume form where you feed the contravariant vector field that is defined here into one of the arguments. The volume form for general relativity is, of course, just the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of g times d4x. What we want to show is that the value, the actual numerical value, the output of the symplectic form stays the same if we stick to the two solutions, even when we deform the space-like hypersurface. We've chosen one coordinate system, and then we have one equal time surface, and then we choose another coordinate system, we have another equal time surface, so we just have this surface grow about. It's still space-like in both cases, but it's a different definition of what we mean by equal time. So this is equal time. These are events of equal time according to one coordinate system, and these are events of equal time according to the other coordinate system. So we can integrate in order to get the value of the symplectic form either way. We can either integrate this way or we can integrate that way. The space-time volume that's enclosed in here, we will call capital B. And then the one space-like hypersurface is sigma, and the other one is called sigma prime. So now we can use Stokes' theorem. And Stokes' theorem says that whether we integrate over the boundary of this, which gives us our symplectic form, or we integrate over the volume, is the same. If we remember, Stokes' theorem says that if we integrate over the boundary of a manifold, it's the same as if we integrate over the bulk of the manifold, but we take the exterior derivative of whatever differential form we have. So the integral over both surfaces, so the entire boundary of B, so both space-like hypersurfaces, the union of sigma and sigma prime, the integral over those both is the same as integrating over the exterior derivative of our J over the bulk of the volume there. So in particular, we are done if we can show that D of J tilde is vanishing. If we can show that it is a closed three form, if we can show that J tilde is a closed three form. And why is that? Well, it's because if it's a closed three form, if dj tilde is 0, well then the integral, then this integral, the integral over the bulk is vanishing because dj tilde is vanishing. Therefore, the integral over the total boundary of the bulk, which is to say the integral over sigma plus the integral over sigma prime, is vanishing, right? Because the right-hand side is vanishing. But that means that the integral over this is equal to the integral over that. It may sound like a contradiction because I just said that the sum of the two is 0. But then I seem to be saying that the difference between the two is 0. So which is it? The sum of the two is 0 or the difference between the two is 0? Yeah, let's see. So if we can show that J tilde is a closed differential form, so if dj tilde is 0, then the right-hand side up there is vanishing. So we have that 0 is equal to the integral over the boundary, because the integral over the bulk is vanishing. But that's the integral over the one hypersurface plus the integral over the other hypersurface, sigma over sigma prime. But you see, according to how the Stokes' theorem works, these integrals are such that in both integrals, this J vector is pointing outside of B. There is a, in Stokes' theorem, you have the inside and the outside. And the integral over the surface is such that it's always, this vector is always pointing outside of the bulk. So in other words, this one is pointing towards the past, and that one is pointing towards the future. What we can do then is we can make that also point towards the future, but that means that we pick up an overall minus sign here. So if we integrate both integrals over if we integrate the integrals over the two hypersurfaces in exactly the same way, then one of them picks up a minus sign. That's why if we integrate the same way over each of the hypersurfaces, we find that their difference is actually 0. But that means that this integral is the same as that integral. And that means that it doesn't matter on which of these space-like hypersurfaces we evaluate the symplectic form. The symplectic form is independent, not just within one coordinate system, the time that you choose in that coordinate system, but also if you change coordinate system and change the very definition of what is a space-like hypersurface, if you change the very definition of what is equal time, it still doesn't matter. So the inner product between two solutions to the Klein coordinate equation is always the same, no matter on which space-like hypersurface you calculate it. Doesn't matter when you calculate it, and it doesn't matter on which space-like hypersurface you calculate. It's always the same number. And that's, of course, crucial, because we base everything about the quantization on that symplectic inner product. Because then we use Darboux's theorem, and then we have this standard form there, and that shows us that we can fulfill the canonical commutation relations. Because remember, from Darboux's theorem, we arrived at the conclusion that there is a resolution of the identity. And then writing down that resolution of the identity explicitly turned out to be the Wronskian condition. So all of this is covariant because of that. But we still have to show that the three-form J tilde really is closed, that its exterior derivative is really vanishing. So that's, again, a little bit of differential geometry, and not too bad if you're not familiar with it. So let's calculate that. The exterior derivative of J tilde is the exterior derivative of the inner derivation of the volume form in the direction of J. So that's also written like this. It's the divergence. It's the divergence of the vector field with respect to the volume form. And that, as we derived last term, can be written in this way. And you probably recognize here the divergence that you know from special relativity. Namely, then the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of G is just 1. And then what you get here is that the divergence is what you obtain when you take a vector field and you differentiate the first component with respect to the first variable in the first direction, the second component in the second direction, etc. That's the divergence. For example, when you calculate the divergence for a fluid field or something like that, you would do it like this. So we need to calculate this expression here. So let's calculate what that is. Square root of g, j mu, and then contracted with mu and summed over. All right, so square root of g is carried forward, and the j mu was this contravariant vector field defined above, and it's this. This, just to remind you, that was the definition of the j field. Now we have to differentiate that whole thing here with respect to mu. We will get four terms. We will write it as the sum of four terms. Let's first work with this one. We have to differentiate that in the mu direction. Well, we will have to differentiate all terms individually with respect to mu. Let's pick out the term where we differentiate the f with respect to mu. That gives us this one, right? So I just wrote down this term here, where the derivative, this one, comma mu, the derivative d by dx mu, is acting on the f. See, so it's square root of g carried forward, g mu nu carried forward, and then the derivative of f in the mu direction, here, derivative of f in the mu direction, and then d nu h carried forward. And then we also have the derivative of the rest with respect to the mu direction. So everything differentiated except for the f. That's this term here. So here we're carrying forward the f because it's not differentiated. And then we take all the rest, the square root of g, the metric, and the d nu h, square root of g, metric, d nu h, and differentiate that. And then we do a very similar thing over here. This thing, I mean, those terms multiplying that have to be differentiated with respect to mu. Again, we start by picking out the term where h is differentiated. That gives us this term. Now we have d mu h and the d nu f over here. And then there's also the terms that we obtain by differentiating that thing with respect to everything but h. So the h gets pulled in front because it's not being differentiated, and the rest gets differentiated. Now we notice that this term is the same as that, except this one has a minus sign, so those two terms go away. And here we have part of the Klein-Gordon equation. I wrote it up for you here again in, as a note on the side. This is actually the massless part of the Klein-Gordon equation. So if the field has no mass, then that is equal to zero. If the field has a mass, then this term is minus m squared h square root of g. And similarly here, we can use the Klein-Gordon equation to write this as minus m squared f square root of g. Remember that we are dealing here with not just arbitrary functions f and g or f and h. No, they're all solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. That's the function space that we are working in. That's why we can use this at this point. So if we do this, if we use the Klein-Gordon equation, I mean, if the field is a massless Klein-Gordon field, then these two terms are vanishing anyway because of the Klein-Gordon equation, and then we're done already. If there is a mass term, then we get these two terms here. I'm collecting them here, and we see that they cancel each other out. F m squared h, h m squared f. Notice that if our theory had a phi to the third or phi to the fourth term in it or something like that, we would have been stuck right here. Because then we would have here powers of, you see, then this would not have been so easy. We would not simply have gotten m squared h square root of absolute value of determinant of d, but instead we would have had like an h term plus an h squared or h to the third term over here. So we would have here, for example, h plus h to the third. But here we would have f plus f to the third, and that just wouldn't have canceled out. But luckily, in cosmology, it seems that for the purpose of calculating the quantum fluctuations that seeded the inhomogeneities in the CMB, it is sufficient to look at a free Klein-Gordon field whose only non-triviality comes from living on a curved space-time. So that's a calculation that we can fortunately do. Okay, so we finally proved that for globally hyperbolic space-times at least, there always exist mode functions, namely these complex-valued solutions, such that our ansatz for phi and pi succeeds, so that it also obeys the canonical commutation relations at all time, and indeed, not just for all times in one coordinate system, but for whatever coordinate system, for whatever slicing of space-time into space like hypersurfaces you may choose. Let's see how all of this abstract stuff looks like in practice, where we know all of these things explicitly. So let's look at Minkowski space. And let's see how all of this stuff plays out there. What is this condition in Minkowski space, and why is it fulfilled? So in Minkowski space, we found this solution for the Klein-Gordon field. If you remember, it was an integral over d3k. And in this case, the k were not some abstract labels, as they may be in general. No, in this case, they were actually momentum variables. And then we have a 1 over square root of 2 omega k. Omega k, if you remember, was just the square root of k vector squared plus m squared. And then we had here ak and ak dagger, creation and annihilation operators, and these functions there. So in total, we can here identify that this stuff multiplied with all of that is the mode function. And that multiplied with this is the complex conjugate to the mode function. So we've identified right away what the uk of x and t are. Okay? Uk of x and t is this times that. Here it is. So the claim is that these mode functions actually fulfill the Wronskian condition. Now the Wronskian condition becomes a little simpler in Minkowski space because there, that determinant is minus 1, absolute value plus 1, square root plus 1, and that's of course just the eta. It's just the eta 0 nu. Because this is just g 0 nu, so it's just a 1. And therefore, we have here that the left-hand side of the Wronskian condition for the canonical, which is necessary to fulfill the canonical commutation relations. So the left-hand side looks like this. because the square root of g, g mu things go away. We know what these mode functions are, and so let's just plug that in. We plug in these prefactors, these, and then we have those plane wave solutions. And then we have to plug the same thing in again, but complex conjugated. That's over here. And then both of them contribute, of course, to these prefactors, but they're real, and that's what they contribute. You remember from above, each mode function alone just has the square root of this. And together they have this prefactor here. This I omega k arose because we differentiate the uk star with respect to x naught. And if we do that, if we differentiate this mode function with respect to the time variable, we get an omega k down, or an I omega k we get down. And here, we have to write down the complex conjugated solution. So this is the complex conjugate of that. That's the complex conjugate of this. We have to differentiate now this function here with respect to the time variable. And that gives us a minus I omega k down here. Notice that we have a minus I omega k and a minus here. And here we have a plus and a plus over there. So they are actually the same kind of term. So we have twice the same term here. And also we have that these things basically cancel each other out. Well, almost. This one is just the inverse of that. But here we have ikx, and if you look very closely, you see this is minus ikx prime. Because this is equal time commutation relations, the t is the same, but this x is not that x prime. It comes from equal time commutation relations. So what's left over from this is e to the power ikx minus x prime. That's the product of this term and that term, and we have it twice. That's why there is a 2 over here, which then cancels the 2 from there. And this I omega k cancels, I mean, the omega k gets canceled down here. We still have a 1 over 2 pi to the third power. So all of this Wronskian integral has now boiled down to what? 1 over 2 pi to the third power integral over just I, rest cancels, I times this plane wave. Three-dimensional plane wave integrated over d3k. Well, what happens when you integrate a plane wave over all of momenta? You get a Dirac delta. Actually, you get a Dirac delta times 2 pi to the power of the dimension. And in this case, it's three dimensions, so you get 2 pi to the third power canceled away, and it's just I times Dirac delta. So indeed, it works out. So what we had as the mode function in Minkowski space obeys this Wronskian condition, and now you saw how it actually comes about in practice. Okay, so far, we have that to solve the quantum field theory for a free Klein-Gordon field on a curved space-time is to solve these three conditions, and we make this ansatz here, where we wrote it as a series, but it could also be an integral, and we showed that at least if the space-time is globally hyperbolic, then there exists a set of solution of the Klein-Gordon equation so that our ansatz solves all the conditions. And in principle, we are done at that point. We solved the quantum field theory on a given background space-time. But is it unique? How do we know we got the right solution if there are many? Actually, there do exist many other such solutions. The choice of mode functions that obey the Wronskian condition is not unique. The Wronskian, even though it looks like a dauntingly difficult to fulfill condition, it actually kind of isn't, because there are plenty of solutions to it. So we could have a family of complex-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, UK, with which we can build our solution to the quantum field theory, namely in here. Right? We could choose some UKs to get our solution, but there are other families of, let's say, UK tildes or UK double tildes that we could also use to solve the quantum field theory. So we could solve the problem as we did, and then we could start over and say we write down a U, sum over U tildes, and then we also have to use A tildes and A dagger tildes because it's a whole new answer. And then we would find again a solution that is just as valid as any other. On curved space-time, there is no, there's nothing that could single one solution out over the other. In principle, they are all valid. But let's see if we can get some intuition for why it's not unique. Remember that we had this symplectic form for real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. V, capital V, was the space of real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. So F and H, if they are solutions, then that was the symplectic form. And then by Dabous' theorem, we had that there exists a basis in that space such that the symplectic form takes this particular form, which is quite amazing if you think about it, because unlike the spectral theorem, which gives you a unique diagonalization with eigenvalues that tell you crucial information about the operator, here it's very different. We have this symplectic form, and once you put it into its standard form by choosing your basis, it always looks like this. There's no eigenvalues or something to be read off. Always looks like that.
So that means the eigenvalues are plus or minus I of that, right?
So minus I. I think you're right.
No.
Then
it's metric, so it's
it would have to be self-adjoint then. Yeah. That's right. Plus or minus I. Okay, so how do we proceed then? Well, from this basis, we then constructed a basis for the complex solutions simply by linearly combining a real two real ones with an I to get a complex solution. And so we had then these complex basis, these basis vectors of the complexified vector space of solutions. And they were themselves complex valued functions. And then it turns out that the Dabous bases are not unique. So here is the simplest possible example. Let us just pick out one of those little squares there, just a two-dimensional subspace of the solution space to the Klein-Gordon equation. So let's say that V1 and V2 are a Dabous basis so that the symplectic form takes this particular shape. So we just focus on this subspace. Or we say that the entire space has only two dimensions. Then can we change bases so that the symplectic form keeps that representation? So let's say that our vectors V, which form a basis according to which a symplectic form takes this shape, can be written as a linear combination of other vectors, V bar. So we apply this matrix, this change of basis matrix, onto these vectors V bar in order to get this one. I could have defined it the other way around, such that the new vector, the new basis vectors V bar, are obtained by applying a change of basis matrix on the V, but then I would have needed some inverses elsewhere. So let us ask, can we change bases so that the symplectic form keeps that particular matrix shape? So is there a matrix Q so that when we calculate Q to the right and Q transpose on the left with that matrix in the middle still gives us the same matrix? If you wonder why that is, what you obtain when you ask for invariance under change of basis, if you want to brush up your linear algebra, I did the calculation over here. So if under change of basis generated by a matrix Q, we want that the symplectic form stays the same. So it's a simple linear algebra problem now. You can ask, well, what condition do we have to impose on the matrix elements of the matrix Q such that this is true? So which changes of basis will preserve the symplectic form? Now, if we write our matrix Q as consisting of this matrix here with as yet unknown coefficients A, B, C, D, then it turns out that any such change of basis matrix Q will preserve the symplectic form if the coefficients of the matrix obey this condition, AD minus BC is equal to 1, which you may recognize as the condition of determinant being equal to 1. Now, that is just giving us one family of possible changes of basis that will keep the symplectic form the same. But in general, you can have much more general changes of basis that will also mix different parts of that matrix here. See, we just picked out one of those little submatrices there, just this two-dimensional subspace. And so we just asked, can we mix the basis a little bit up, this two-dimensional space? Can we change spaces in this two-dimensional space and preserve that? Yes, we can, and we saw the condition for that. But we can, in principle, also ask, can we mix up the whole thing and still preserve that shape? And we can do that. Now, let's do that question for the complexified version already. So this is what was the two-dimensional real-valued case. Now, let's look at the Hermitian bilinear form that we get for the complexified version. Remember that when we looked at the space of complex solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, we introduced this square bracket, or this angled bracket here. And this angled bracket has this property, namely that the complex basis vectors un and um are orthonormal to each other, and their complex conjugates are kind of orthonormal, but it's not positive definite. There's a minus sign. And they're orthogonal to each other across the starred and the unstarred solutions. Then we can ask again, what change of basis can we do in the space of complex solutions without messing up that structure? Because that is the complex analog of what was previously the thing for the real valued solutions, where we had this matrix of plus one and minus one. Once we rewrite things in terms of the complex solutions and then define the angled product, this is the structure that needs to be preserved, which is a Hermitian bilinear form instead of a symplectic one. So let us now write down the general challenge. Let us write down a new set of basis vectors. I mean, the U and the U star are basis vectors in the space of complex solutions that obey this, or in this basis, the angled product, which is really the Wronskian's left-hand side, this product takes this particular form. And now we ask, can we move from this basis, the U basis, to an entirely new basis that we may call UN bar, together with the complex conjugate functions UN bar star, in such a way that the UN and the UN bar star, and the UN bar and the UN bar star still obey that structure. So that still, we obey the Wronskian condition. And the most general thing we can write down is that the new basis vectors, the new basis of solutions, of complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, is a linear combination of the old ones. So here is the set of old basis vectors, and then the ANM and BNM matrices are just big matrices, in principle so far completely arbitrary, that map the old basis vectors into the new basis vectors. So you see, the challenge is not to make sure that these guys are solutions, because our equation of motion is linear. The Klein-Gordon equation is linear. So if this is a solution, that's a solution, and these guys are just constant coefficient matrices, then any of these linear combinations is going to be a solution too. That's going to be a complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. No, the challenge is to make sure that these are not just a bunch of any kind of solution. No, we want them to be a Darboux basis. We want them to be such that this holds true with the bars. Now, what you can show is, it's a little calculation of linear algebra, that in order for the set of the new basis vectors un bar and un bar star to qualify as mode functions, for them to qualify to give us a solution in our ansatz, so for them to obey these conditions, the matrices A and B cannot be chosen arbitrarily, but instead, they have to obey these conditions. And it turns out that there are many, many solutions to those conditions here. We will get this change of basis matrices again, because they are related to the Bogoliubov transformations that we have been discussing earlier. And remember from when we had the driven harmonic oscillator, we had A in and A out operators. And similarly here, when we have different solutions with different A and A dagger operators, there's going to be a relationship between them, and it will be governed by these matrices A and B.
I wanted to ask that we showed a couple lectures ago that if your mode functions are in the Darboux basis, then they will satisfy the Lebrunsen condition. But is it also true that if you require your mode functions to satisfy the Lebrunsen condition, they must be in the Darboux basis?
Yes, it's the same thing. So what we arrived at is a finding of a tremendous non-uniqueness. There are a lot of solutions. So we can write our ansatz for phi of x and t and find a solution like this, or find a solution like that, or find a solution like that. Different mode functions, and they can look very different. And for each choice of mode function, we have some other A and A dagger operators. We always ask them to be constant in space and time. We always have them obey the canonical commutation relations, but they're just different operators.
Question?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing, this also holds for the flat space time, right? Did I understand
correctly? For what space time?
We also have a non-uniqueness in the flat space time.
Flat, that's right. In Minkowski space as well. That's right. Yes, and we will discuss how we handle the non-uniqueness there and compare it to the non-uniqueness in general relativity. You see, it's just that in Minkowski space, it's much easier to identify what should be done. And in curved space, we will have to redo this whole argument and question what we did in Minkowski space. Okay, so we have many, many, not just three. Infinitely many ways to solve the Klein-Gordon equation on curved space-time. But it matters in principle, it would seem so, that it matters which solution we choose. For example, if we choose this way of solving the Klein-Gordon equation with a particular set of mode functions and A and A dagger operators, then we can define a vector zero. I won't call it the vacuum just yet, because we don't know it's the vacuum. So let's just call it a vector zero. We can define such a vector as the vector that is annihilated by all of the AK operators. And remember, this is general curved space-time. The K doesn't have to be momentum or anything. It just labels a bunch of solutions. So in any case, we can define, relative to this choice of solving the problem, we can define a vector zero, and then we can build on that vector, we normalize it, and then we can build on that vector an entire Fock space, which is to say we apply the A dagger operators arbitrarily many times on this vector zero, and then we get vectors that are orthogonal to each other. We can normalize them, and we get these guys, and we can take linear combinations of them, and we can apply not just the AK dagger so many times, but we can also take AK prime dagger, apply it so many times. We can build up an entire Fock space, and that Fock space will span the Hilbert space of our theory. So in other words, once you've made up your mind about which solutions you want to work with, you get for free a particular choice of bases. Because once you've chosen your solutions, you have A and A dagger operators that come along with it. And those A and A dagger operators will help you generate a basis of the Hilbert space. Now, if you change your mind and you use different mode functions, and we will find occasion to do this, sometimes use this set of mode functions, sometimes use that set of mode functions. So if you now choose another set of mode functions, because it might be convenient for calculating some aspect of your of the problem that you're trying to address, well, then they come with their own A and A dagger operators, and they then span, you can use them to span a basis in the same Hilbert space, but it's going to be a different basis. There's going to be some rotation between those Fock bases. So that's an orthonormal basis, that's an orthonormal basis. There's got to be some unitary in between them.
Mm-hmm. In the continuum, it's not normalizable, right?
Yes, that's right.
Any problems? Because then it's not even technically a vector in the Hilbert space.
That's right. In principle, that's a problem, and there are people who worry deeply about this. But for our purposes, it's not a problem because it will go away when we put the whole thing into a big box. Now, if you're considering problems where you can't put the system into a big box, then there might be a concern. But generally speaking, I would not worry about that. There are other issues that come up, related issues, where it matters to some extent, but not for cosmology. It matters for particle physics. And we will get to that today. OK, so for every choice of solving the quantum field theory, we get their own mode functions, and we get their own A and A dagger operators, and they span a Hilbert space. They span a basis. No, they generate a basis in this way, which span a Hilbert space. Now, I already said that these are going to be Hilbert bases in the same Hilbert space, and therefore there's going to be a unitary transformation between them. But how do we know that? Do we really know that for sure? Do these solutions of the quantum field theory describe different physics, or do they differ by a mere change of basis in the Fock space and therefore describe the same physics? I already gave it away by saying, yes, there's going to be unitary transformation between them. But strictly speaking, it depends on conditions such as what Nicholas was, what Peter was referring to. So it depends. There can be subtleties. Let us first assume that we can impose infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs with negligible consequences. And yeah, we'll have to worry about whether or not there could be non-negligible consequences of imposing an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff. So let's assume that, just like in the project to this course, we put the whole thing into a box, and we also assume that not arbitrarily high momenta can occur. So it has both an infrared cutoff in the large scales and an ultraviolet cutoff in the very small scales. And that means that only a finite number of modes survive after these cutoffs. So the infrared cutoff makes the set of modes discrete, and then the ultraviolet cutoff cuts them off at some high value, so we just have a finite number of degrees of freedom. So we have a finite number of independent mode oscillators, AN and AN dagger. Then we can apply a theorem which states that all solutions to these to the conditions of the quantum field theory differ merely by a change of basis. So the theorem is the Stone and von Neumann theorem. And I'll give you here a non-technical version, and then I'll tell you what the difficulties are. So assume that in a Hilbert space H, the operators x hat I and p hat j obey the canonical commutation relations. And let's assume that there are only finitely many of them. This is similar to what we have in quantum field theory, where we have phi hat and pi hat operators, and after an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, they obey these commutation relations, and there are only finitely many of them. Then assume that in another Hilbert space, H tilde, there are other operators, X tilde and P tilde, which also obey these canonical commutation relations. And let's assume that these representations are irreducible. So there are no invariant subspaces. Further, we can assume that the two Hilbert spaces are the same. And that is based on another theorem. And that theorem says that all Hilbert spaces that have the cardinality of countable infinity are isomorphic. So you see, when you take a vector space of dimension 5, it is not isomorphic to a vector space of dimension 50. If you take a Hilbert space of dimension infinite, it may or may not be isomorphic to a Hilbert space of dimension infinite, because there can be different kinds of infinity. Now, there is a special kind of Hilbert spaces which is called separable, and that means that they have a countable basis. These are the Hilbert spaces that we work with in quantum theory, almost exclusively. So in quantum mechanics, for example, our Hilbert space can be spanned by a countable basis always. For example, you could choose the basis vectors of the harmonic oscillators, the discrete set. It's infinitely many basis vectors, but countable, as opposed to a continuum, which wouldn't be countable. So the Hilbert space of quantum mechanics is always separable Hilbert space in the sense that there exists a countable basis. And it turns out that Hilbert spaces of equal cardinality actually are isomorphic. So if, for example, you consider the Hilbert space of a one-dimensional quantum harmonic oscillator, its cardinality is countable infinite, the separable Hilbert space. If you now take the Hilbert space of not one quantum harmonic oscillator, but of an Avogadro number of them, like in a crystal, still finitely many, but like 10 to the 23 of them or so, that Hilbert space's cardinality is countable infinite still. Right? Because you just have a finite number times countable infinite that's still countable infinite. And that means that the Hilbert space of an Avogadro number of particles is actually the exact same size as that of just a one-dimensional harmonic oscillator, for example, or one-dimensional free particle, whatever. And in fact, the Hilbert space of a quantum field theory that you have cut off in the ultraviolet and in the infrared is also just as big, no bigger, no smaller, than the Hilbert space of one single lonely quantum harmonic oscillator. It's always just countable infinite.
You wouldn't even have to cut it off in the ultraviolet, would you?
You would have to, because otherwise you would have infinitely many of them.
Isn't that still countable? Countable times countable?
No? It's countable times finite. I'll show you in a moment how the issue arises. Okay, so we assume now that the two Hilbert spaces are the same because they are isomorphic. So we can always view this as having the situation of two sets of operators represented on the same Hilbert space. And both of them obey the same canonical commutation relations. Then the claim is that there always exists a unitary operator from the Hilbert space into itself, which maps by the adjoint action, I mean, by multiplying u to the left and u dagger to the right, just like the time evolution of a quantum system, it is mapping the operators, the untilded operators into the tilded operators, which is to say that by a change of basis generated by a matrix u, by unitary u, by a change of basis, you find that the x can be expressed in terms of the x tilde. They are really the same operators up to a change of basis. You can also formulate this without saying that h is equal to h tilde, but then this unitary wouldn't be mapping from the Hilbert space into itself, but it would be mapping from one Hilbert space into another Hilbert space, and then it cannot longer be called a unitary, it would be an isometry. And I just, you know, it's just a technicality, but it's the same thing. Same statement. So that means that if you have just a finite number of degrees of freedom, finite number of pairs x and p, then any representation of the canonical commutation relations is as good as any other. They just differ by a change of basis in the Hilbert space. Now, strictly speaking, I simplified things a little bit. There can actually be pathological cases. I always wanted to look into those pathological cases, but I never got around to doing this. But there are cases of weird representations of the canonical commutation relations that nobody has found any use for in physics. And I thought I'd look into them just to see maybe they could be useful for something. It's a non-trivial thing. For example, the rotation group as a Lie algebra and its representation theory is non-trivial. And there are things other than just rotations of objects. And that would be spins. And nature makes use of those. So it could be, in principle, that if there are some pathological cases that contradict the statement that we just had, so non-unitarily equivalent representations of the canonical commutation relations, they might carry some physical significance at some point. It might be interesting to look into it. But the theorem is still a theorem. Because it's actually, in the literature, not formulated for the canonical commutation relations between the x and the p's, but instead for the exponentiated versions. When you exponentiate x hat and you exponentiate the p hat, then you're no longer dealing with unbounded self-adjoint operators, but instead with bounded unitary operators. And bounded, the functional analysis of bounded operators is much easier because there are no questions of domain and codomain anymore. Because bounded operators can map the entire Hilbert space into the entire Hilbert space, whereas unbounded self-adjoint operators can never act on the entire Hilbert space. So there is an issue there, a technical issue, which opens up a loophole. If you close that loophole by working with the exponentiated positional momentum operators, then the theorem becomes strict, and there are no exceptions. So the commutation relations of these exponentiated guys, they are unique. So now we can apply this to quantum mechanics and to quantum field theory after ultraviolet and infrared regularizations. So in particular, we can write down operators x, which are written as a plus a dagger, and p that are minus I, a minus a dagger, and also barred operators, with barred creation and annihilation operators. And if they both obey the canonical commutation relations, then by the theorem of Stone for Neumann, we can conclude that the unbarred operators must be obtainable from the barred operators by a change of basis. So there's got to be a unitary matrix, unitary operator that maps the unbarred to the barred operators.
Is there a cross missing for the U there?
Ah, yes, there is. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Unfortunately, it's a PDF. I can't write on it. I'll try to remember to fix it tonight. Very good. Okay, so that means all solutions to the problem of solving the canonical commutation relations are related by a unitary matrix. They are related by change of bases. Now, coming back to Peter's question here, what if we cannot truncate? What if we cannot impose an infrared or ultraviolet cutoff? Let's say not impose an infrared cutoff in order to obtain a finite number of degrees of freedom. When would that happen? Well, that happens technically in an interesting way. It happens in the case of so-called phase transitions. And by phase transitions is really meant phase transitions as you remember it from a first year course. You know, water melting or ice melting. Sorry, water melting.
It's like, well, it is water when it's ice, so.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with saying water melts.
Oh, that's true. It's still water, yeah. A bit like a horse that's riding. It's not. Mm-hmm. Imagine how that would look like, a horse sitting on another horse. Anyway. Okay. So in the case of phase transitions, this happens. If you remember the case... Okay, if you remember, strictly speaking, phase transitions can only happen in systems that are infinitely large. So for example, a superconducting phase transition. It's a sharp transition. But if your superconductor is not infinitely large, then it's not an infinitely sharp transition. It's actually a curve. It takes a little while. And so in order to get actual phase transitions, sharp phase transitions, where the behavior totally changes the point, you actually need that the system is infinitely large. And in quantum field theory, we usually don't worry much about phase transitions, but the issue has been raised that there could be phase transitions in quantum field theory, phenomena that only occur for infinitely large systems. Now, of course, the universe may be infinite in size or not, but if that happens, then even at a finite size, but very large size, you would see the impact of phase transitions just like there can be finite size superconductors. So it is something to worry about. And so indeed, when you have a system that has infinitely many degrees of freedom, even if it's countably infinitely many, even if you have let's say you have an infrared cutoff, but you don't have an ultraviolet cutoff, or the other way around, then you can have unitarily non-equivalent solutions that physically differ by describing different phases. And the mathematics of how this occurs is this. I'm trying to boil it down here to the bare essentials of it. So what is the underlying mathematics of non-equivalent representations occurring when you make your system arbitrarily large? Well, imagine that you have a spin, very simple, just a spin, and you have two states for the spin, either the state A or the state B. And let's say that the two spin states are almost pointing in the same direction, but not exactly the same direction. So then the inner product of the two states is going to be some number alpha whose modulus is smaller than 1. Let's assume it's real, and so it's some value between 0 and 1. That's what you get when you have two spin states that are almost pointing in the same direction, but are not the same. So in particular, they are not orthogonal to each other. And what that means is, for example, that if your Hilbert space is two-dimensional, you can use the two of them to span it. Even though they're not orthogonal, they're still spanning the space. Right? I mean, even if they're very close together like that, they span the entire space. Now, okay. Now let us look at the situation where you have lots of spins. And they are prepared similarly. So you have two states here, it could either be in that state or in that, and there's a little angle in between them. And then when you have lots of those spins, then let us calculate what the inner product is of that total state now. Well, you see, this vector is going to contract with that one, and the second one with the second one, etc. And each time you contract them, you pick up a factor of alpha. And so the entire inner product for the bigger system is alpha to the power n. And you see, something is happening now when the when you take your system to infinite size, when you take infinitely many spins, because then something happens to that inner product. It becomes zero. So instead of having a finite angle to each other, they actually become orthogonal to each other. Just because you took infinitely many of them, because alpha to the power n goes to zero. It's of course never actually zero as long as you have finitely many spins. But in the limit for the system going to infinity, you find that things go orthogonal that were not orthogonal before. So in particular, you can find that this vector becomes orthogonal to that. Yeah, and that has eventually consequences then in representation theory. But from now on, we will simply assume that infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs are possible, and that we are not missing out on something important, such as phase transition, and therefore that that the Stone and von Neumann theorem applies.
I have a technical question. Even if we put IR and UV, there are uncountably many momentum values between.
No, that's the point of having the infrared cutoff. You see, after the infrared cutoff, if you put it into a box, then the momenta become discrete. Right? Because remember, in the box, you can only have an integer number of wavelengths fit in there, so the momenta become discrete, but still arbitrarily short wavelengths. So then with an ultraviolet cutoff, you're cutting off how short the wavelengths can get, and that makes it finite.
Yeah. One more question.
Okay.
We have a non-uniqueness here. Did that also occur in quantum mechanics that we somehow overlooked?
No, it didn't occur there, because in quantum mechanics we never consider infinitely many particles. We might consider an ion atom or something, which would have on the order of 50 electrons, but not infinitely many. You could try to do the quantum mechanics of a crystal in first quantization, and then that would occur if you make your crystal infinite in size. But then actually, usually the quantum theory of a crystal is done with quantum field theory. Quantum field theory for phonons and quantum field theory for other collective excitations in quasi-particles, and then it's in the second quantized framework. Okay, so we assume that Stone and von Neumann applies, because without penalty, without missing out on important phenomena, by assumption, we can truncate to a finite number of degrees of freedom, even if it's astronomically large. So because Stone von Neumann, by assumption, holds, and therefore all the solutions only differ by a change of basis, we can conclude that no matter which set of suitable mode functions we choose, the UN solutions, the UN bar, the UN double bar solutions, etc., we obtain that the solution for the quantum field theory is always the same, even though we write here mode function one mode function here is another set of mode functions, another set of mode functions. Actually, because they have different operators, all of this is the same thing. It's always the same solution. It's just that there's a unitary transformation between these guys and those guys and those guys. And this will be Bogoliubov transformation. So if we write down the quantum field in this way, then our A and A dagger operators will generate an orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. If we use those guys will generate a different orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. But by Stone von Neumann, there is a unitary transformation between the two. They're just differing by a choice of bases. So all we get if we, our choice in which mode solutions we take is ultimately immaterial because we are writing down the same solution. Where it does make a difference is this comes with one choice of Hilbert basis, that comes with another choice of Hilbert basis, and one choice of Hilbert basis might be more convenient than another. For example, if we know which state is the vacuum state, then we may want to choose mode functions such that what we know to be the vacuum state is annihilated by those A operators. Because then applying A daggers will create N particle states for us. But that's a matter of convenience. We could also use these or those. Same thing, it's just not as convenient then. Doesn't matter which basis we choose. Any state can be expressed in any basis. So for example, if we use the mode functions UK, we are led to span the Hilbert space using this orthonormal basis, the basis which is generated by a vector zero, which is identified as the one that is annihilated by all of the AK operators. And then this is the way we span the Hilbert basis. Or alternatively, we choose another set of mode functions. For example, these could be solutions that are similar to being plane wave solutions. These could be similar to being wave packet solutions. Anything goes. They just have to be solutions and complete. So we just have to make sure that these Wronskian conditions are holding. So we span the same Hilbert space using this Hilbert basis. So then does the choice of mode functions matter? In principle, it does not. As we just said, any state of the system, psi, any state psi can be expanded in each basis. However, in practice, it is convenient whenever we know which state is the no particle or vacuum state. And we might call that state capital omega. It is convenient to choose mode functions UK such that this state happens to be the state that is annihilated by all of the AK operators. Because then we already know that multiple applications of A dagger will generate what looks like multiparticle states then. Also notice that I wrote here, I snuck in some little detail that will concern us quite a bit a little later. I said here, when we know which state is the no particle state, the vacuum state, so what we are adopting here already is the convention that we say the vacuum state is the state of no particles. Okay, so the idea is that of a vacuum cleaner, right? So you clean out all the particles, what's left is the vacuum state. You could also have tried to define the vacuum state as the lowest energy state. But as we will later find out, we don't get through with that. That wouldn't be right. There's a difference between a no particle state and the lowest energy state. And what we should go by is the no particle state.
What other way do we have of saying that it's a no-particle state other than it's annihilated by the A operators?
Well, imagine if that was the only criterion, then we would have lots of vacuum states. because we have lots of solution case, right? No, we have to look for another criterion.
So
far we haven't got.
What in physics tells us that it's a vacuum state?
All right, I can give it away already. Okay. Okay, so it's not the minimum energy state. And I can tell you already why it's not the minimum energy state. We could define, I mean, it's the state of minimum energy, right? But if we adopt that definition and we apply it to the universe as we see it, then we would find that there must be tremendous particle creation. If this is our definition of the vacuum state, then just the regular expansion of the universe, as it is expanding now, is sufficient to parametrically excite the harmonic oscillators in the quantum field sufficiently to create so many particles that it would be observable. It would be a large amount. It's more than is compatible with experiments. So the minimum energy state cannot be the proper identification of the vacuum state. And because of that, the definition that has been adopted and that we will do in detail is this. We will look for a criterion to identify the vacuum state that should have the property that, according to that criterion, the amount of particle production in an expanding space-time is minimal. Because we must be consistent with observation. That is the so-called adiabatic vacuum. You see how that then works, right? And so we impose that adiabatic vacuum condition, and that will tell us which set of mode functions UK we should choose. And depending on what the universe does, it might do at early times, it might expand in one way. At later times, it might expand more dramatically or less dramatically, and so on. It might do funny things. When you apply the vacuum identification criterion, the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion, at different times, you find different states in the Hilbert space, which means that there's a necessity for particle creation. Because if you say that it's the vacuum now, it's not going to be the vacuum later. Because we are working in the Heisenberg picture, and there we see that the state is always frozen. So there is no unique vacuum state. It depends on when we look for it and how we identify the vacuum state. And the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion is also not considered to be perfect. As you will see, it involves a bit of perturbation theory, and it doesn't apply really to generic curved spacetimes that might be simultaneously growing and shrinking and things like that. Was that your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Basically, nobody knows how to reliably identify the vacuum. And I have the suspicion that generically there just isn't such a state. Everything we do will be an approximation there. Okay, so in practice, it is convenient whenever we know which state is the no particle or vacuum state to choose the mode function such that that is the state which is annihilated by the A operators of that solution there. And then we can go from there. And so here's just an outlook. Right, that's what I think I said already everything in there. Namely, we identify the vacuum at an early time. We identify the vacuums at a late time. If it's not the same state, there must have been particle creation, and we will calculate that amount of particle creation. Very similarly to how a harmonic oscillator behaves when externally driven, except that here it's parametrically driven. But other than that, it's very similar to the calculation that we did earlier in the course, with the Bogoliubov transformation from the A in to the A out states and all of that. Right, and in this way we can then describe cosmological particle creation through expansion. But particle creation through expansion is not the main thing that we will be aiming at. In fact, particle creation through expansion is something that so-called steady-state universe cosmologists hoped for. as an alternative to the Big Bang theory. There was a theory over the past decades which posited that, yes, the universe is expanding. There's no way around that. We see the Hubble law. We see that everything is accelerating away from us. But moving away from us, and the further away it is, the faster it is. But it could still be that there's no Big Bang. It could be, in principle, that the universe is expanding, everything is drifting away from each other, but because of the expansion, particles are being generated all the time and repopulate the universe so that there is obviously gas popping up, so to speak, between the galaxies. The galaxies move away from each other, but all this empty space is refilling itself just because of the expansion with matter, which then can again condense and form fresh galaxies and so on. So the overall idea was that there could be a steady state universe that is, yes, it's growing, but it's not diluting, it's replenishing itself. At the time when they proposed this seriously, like in the 50s and 60s, they didn't really have a mechanism for the replenishment. Now with quantum field theory we have, but they didn't have it at the time. But in any case, we know now it's nonsense. It's not how the universe works. We can look back, the presence of the CMB is already saying, there's something happened there. We know how old the universe is. So, but in principle, that could have been a possibility. And here is the method to calculate how much particle production we have because of expansion. And since we don't have experimental evidence for any significant particle creation because of expansion, we have to keep that as a minimum. No, the main output of our calculations here is going to be the inflationary mechanism, which is not just parametric excitation of these harmonic oscillators to create particles. No, as I mentioned earlier, the harmonic oscillators don't just go like this non-adiabatically, they go like this, they go like that. So that the particle picture itself breaks down, because these are inverted harmonic oscillators. They don't have a discrete energy spectrum. They have this continuous energy spectrum with runaway solution. And the particle picture even breaks down. It becomes more dramatic than just particle creation. But still, it's the same machinery needed for that as well. You look like you have a question?
Yes.
Yes.
Is the state with the lowest particle production due to expansion, is that low enough to match the data?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
How does this relate to the cosmological constant?
Yeah, very interesting. The thing is this, when I taught this course previously, not the last teaching, but I think the last to last teaching before this one, at this point, there were two students in the class. The same students that I actually wrote a paper with, but we also had another project. And here the idea was this. You know, we got together after class and we thought this through, we discussed it, and we had this idea that the fact that the vacuum state is not the minimum energy state means that the vacuum state, the no particle state, is a state of elevated energy. Right? Because only the lowest energy state can be the lowest energy. Any other state must have elevated energy. So then we thought, how much is that? Could that account for the cosmological constant? And then we put some effort into calculating this. It was very frustrating because we found out that somebody else had published the basic idea. They did the calculation wrong, but they already took the wind out of our sails by having the overall idea. And so we never actually completed that. But I still don't know what the answer is. I just know that they didn't do it right. Yeah. Okay, I guess that's it for today.